Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Bristol Crime Fest. I'm Peter Guttridge. I'm the Observer's crime fiction critic and a crime writer, and I'm really pleased to have been asked to talk to Peter James, who I hope I can regard as a friend, but also is a very fine...
I'll tell you at the end.
also is a very fine crime writer, translated into numerous languages. We're going to start by talking about a book that none of you have seen yet, but we're then going to range over the career of yourself and your detective, Roy Grace. And then there'll be ample time for you to ask questions, and then Peter will be signing copies of his books afterwards. Please welcome Peter James. There is a lot to talk about, but let's start with Dead Man's Grip, which comes out this week. Thursday. Yeah. Tell us about it.
It's the seventh in the Roy Grace series, and I have an American angle in it, although it's primarily set in Brighton. In a nutshell, the story is a bad road traffic accident. It's a 42-year-old mother driving her son to school, and she has to go to work, and she's been on a blind date the night before, and she's woken up with a hangover, and she drops her son at school, and she's hurrying to get to work, and pulls out on a main road in the middle of Brighton, and her phone rings, and she does the right thing. She doesn't answer it, but she's distracted for a second, and when she looks up, she sees a 20-year-old boy on a bicycle come out of a side turning straight at her. She swerves, misses him, crashes into the wall of an empty cafe. A van behind her hits the cyclist and knocks him across the road, and he goes under the wheels of a heavy truck coming the other way. And the police turn up, and the woman is breathalyzed, and she's over the limit from the night before. And the van driver's done a hit and run and vanished. And the truck driver's driven a load of frozen fish down from Aberdeen. He's driven 18 hours non-stop, so he's out of hours. And they then identify the dead boy, who's a student at Brighton University, and he's from New York. And he's in Brighton because he fell in love with a girl from Brighton he met, and he's come over to be with her. And the police discover his mother is the daughter of the New York Mafia godfather. She doesn't like what's happened.
That is a great premise, as indeed all your novels have got great premises. But what's interesting about the way you just described it is, in fact, that accident sounds very real, and one can imagine that happening in real life. And one of the things that I think make your book special is that you are really interested in getting the detail of reality right.
Thank you. I've actually been tweeting the first chapter of the book line by line just for a bit of fun. But what I have got, when I was created the accident, I wanted to make sure it was feasible. And I had tremendous help from the road. They used to call them traffic police, and now call them road policing unit. And you don't have a traffic accident anymore. It's a collision, because there's always somebody to blame. In the kind of parlance of the genre. And the road collision accident investigation team kindly did all accidents now. They actually do computer mock-ups. Because one thing about car accidents is, or any kind of road accident, is that very few witnesses actually see the whole thing. Usually they catch a snatch of it, and then their brain puts together a construct which is quite often inaccurate. So what they now do is they have a very clever system where they will take all the measurements, the skid marks, and they can even take interior of the car measurements. They can tell if I was wearing these jeans and I was in a car that was in a 30-mile-an-hour collision, I will leave fibers of these jeans on the seat. They can tell the impact speed. They can tell whether the indicators were on or not, whether the lights were on or not, from how the bulbs have broken, because they break differently if they're hot. So if you lied and you said, oh, well, actually, Peter was driving, it wasn't me, I was sitting in the passenger seat, they could tell it was me from the fibers of my clothes.
Right. And they
then put all this stuff into a computer, and the computer then bottles the accident as it probably does happen. And they did this, they actually created a CAD moving image of the accident.
What,
from
for
two
you?
From two perspectives, one of the, from the bicycle and one from the car. And I'm going to put that on my website next week, so you can...
Now, when you say they did that for you, that's because you've got a very, very close relationship with the police in Sussex.
Yeah, I'm lucky. I've been... I go out with the police, mostly in Sussex, but in other parts of the UK and elsewhere in the world, very regularly. I'm in Sussex almost on a weekly basis. My relationship started when before Roy Grace and before my kind of supernatural thrillers, I wrote three very bad spy thrillers, which I keep out of print. If you ever see them, just ignore them. And just after the first one had come out, Dead Letter Drop, myself and my then wife were burgled. And this young detective came around to the house and he said, "Is that your book?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "If you ever want any research, give me a call." And we got friendly with him and his wife was also a police officer. They started inviting us to barbecues or to a boxing fight. And I realized that almost all of their friends were police officers and that it's a very inclusive world. And that's partly because that's who they mix with at work, but it's also their comfort zone. Mm. They can talk to each other about a case they're working on without worrying that it's going to be in the press the next day, or they can tell some terrible, sick joke.
Yeah.
Because the police do thrive on gallows humour. I mean, just as an example, there was a really bad road accident very near where we live in Sussex, and the guy skidded off the road and was impaled on a post and died. And one of the cops I was talking to later, he said, "Yeah, told his wife he was just popping out for a steak." But if they don't have that, they would go insane. And the ambulance crews have it too. I did a couple of 12-hour shifts out with paramedics in Brighton because I wanted to know how the paramedics view an accident and what happens. And they have this wonderfully sick expression for a single vehicle fatality. It's called a DODI. It stands for Deb One Did It. And then there's something you do not ever want to be. Nobody in this room ever wants to be. It's a FUBAR Bundy. Does anybody know what that is?
The FUBAR bit I can guess, but the rest I can't guess.
So if they turn up to a really bad accident and clearly the victim is alive but not going to make it, they'll go, FUBAR Bundy. Stands for fucked up beyond all recovery, but unfortunately not dead yet.
Well, I mean, for you knowing this means obviously they've kind of taken you into their confidence and they've accepted you. Did that happen quite early on with I think the guy you were talking about is your friend David?
Dave Gaylor.
Yeah, Dave Gaylor.
It took quite a while. It probably took me about 5 to 10 years, I guess, I started just developing relationships, and the more police I met, the more I found they would invite me to see something. I think that everyone who does a job, whatever it is, whether you're a bookseller, whether you're a brain surgeon, taxi driver, a lawyer, if you're reading about it or see it on television, you like to see it portrayed accurately. And the police, I'm sure part of the reason give me so much help is they cannot stand seeing things gotten wrong. If I talk to quite a few police officers' wives, and they say, or conversely, there's quite a few female police married to others, and they'll say, "My husband shouts at the screen if there's something on and they've got it wrong." And Helen, my beloved, knows I do the same. I can't understand, why no film director on television is capable of putting the senior investigating officer into a protective clothes. It's a very basic, simple thing, but when at a crime scene, the first person to turn up to a crime scene, doesn't matter who he is, if he's a PCSO, constable on his first day out of probation. If he arrives at, say, a murder scene, his first job is to tape it off. His second job is to create a path to the body as narrow as possible so that nothing is contaminated. And his third job is to let no one under that tape, not even the chief constable, without signing the form and without wearing protective clothing, so they do not contaminate the crime scene. And yet every damn television show you see with cops in, there's all the sockos, and then the senior investigating officer walks all over it in his Mac and clothes. It drives other police officers nuts.
But do you think it drives general readers nuts, or is it just people who specifically know?
I think people are just in the know. But if you think that there are 500,000 police officers and support staff in the UK,
that's a good market.
A big market that it's worth trying to get.
Yeah. And you feel the need to still continue spending so much time with the police?
Yeah, I think like any professional, probably more than any other, the police are constantly changing.
It's evolving.
And their acronyms changing. Like in the last years, it's gone from traffic police to road policing unit. And their techniques are constantly changing. Particularly in England now, with all the budget cuts, you've got forces starting to sort of merge. But it's more forensic techniques than anything else that changed. I mean, 2 years ago, you could not take a fingerprint from a piece of plastic immersed in seawater. Now you can. There's a phenomenally complex machine that does it. And police techniques are evolving. Now, there's a constant catch-up going between crooks and the police. And I try to sort of keep at the forefront of that.
Yeah. And am I right in thinking that your friend Dave Gaylor reads the work in progress?
Yes. I mean, I was very lucky. About 15 years ago, I was taken to meet this detective inspector in Brighton called Dave Gaylor. And I went to his office, and it was full of blue and green plastic crates bulging with manila folders. I think crime novels are the only places you ever see a manila folder. You don't see them in literary fiction, but and in police offices. And I said, "Are you moving office?" And he said, "No, these are my dead friends." I said, "Great, I've met the only weirdo in Sussex CID." And he then explained he'd just been, in addition to being a homicide investigator, he'd been asked to reopen cold cases that were in the Sussex area and apply new forensic techniques, the latest fingerprint, the latest DNA techniques. And he said, "I'm the last chance each of the family victims has for justice. And I'm the last chance each family has for closure." And I loved that very human image about him. It's something I've found actually about, in particular, homicide detectives. Almost invariably, they'll bond with the family of the victim, and it becomes personal. That's why so many, even after retirement, still stay on the case. But to be a good detective, one of the qualities is you have to have a high degree of emotional intelligence, a very open mind, and also very good at puzzles, because every homicide is a puzzle. And Dave, this was 15 years ago, and I was working on one of my earlier thrillers, and he said to me, "What are you writing?" And I told him the book I was working on. He said, "But have you thought about that? And don't you think that would happen?" And I suddenly realized he had this very incisive mind. When I was asked to create a new detective by Macmillan, I went to Dave and I said, "How do you fancy being a fictional detective?" And he loved it. And he is my real-life Roy Grace. Doesn't look like him, yeah. But he kind of sits in the shadows. He reads the book as every 100 pages. And he tells me how Roy Grace would think as a detective. And he rose to become Detective Chief Superintendent, head of major crime, Sussex CID. So, very knowledgeable. So it's a fantastic safe pair of hands that I have guiding the decisions Roy Grace makes.
Yeah. I mean, whilst you are very accurate, obviously, about police procedures, these aren't actually police procedurals, really, are they?
No, I'm trying to write thrillers. I mean, I was asked some years back why did I take so long before I started writing crime novels? Because I always wanted to write crime novels when I was a child, but I read Sherlock Holmes' story when I was 8, and Watson said, "Gosh, Holmes, how did you deduce that?" And Watson said, and Holmes said, "Dear Watson, I knew you were looking for a man whose bathroom window was on the left-hand side of his wash basin." And Watson said, "Well, how, Holmes?" He said, "Dear Watson, if you've never noticed, he's always better shaved on the left-hand side of his face." At 8 years old, I said, "One day I'm going to try and create a detective with powers of observation like that." But then, I thought to myself, the English crime genre has all these very strict rules and conventions. You know, if you take the Agatha Christie kind of model, even the Wilkie Collins, the sort of Dorothy L. Sayers, you start with a body, and the whole story is the procedure to solve the murder. And you had, I thought, right, you've got to have a little frisson of sex, a little frisson of violence, a little bit of mystery, a little bit of religion, and invariably a country house setting. So I came up with what I thought was the perfect opening line for a crime novel. "Fuck me, I've been shot," said the vicar's wife, as her knickers hit the library floor of Ponsonby Towers with a crash. I've spared my reading.
Can we steal that?
If you want to use it, I have spared my public. But it kind of... that's why I kept away from... And then I realized one of the big wow moments for me was Silence of the Lambs. And there was a novel that, although it was a police procedure, was blatantly a thriller.
Yeah.
I mean, even with elements of kind of horror in it. And that was one of the number of books, and some of the American writers I was reading, that made me realize, Ed McBain, that you could actually write within the, if you like, the frame of a police procedural, you could actually write thrillers and more action and suspense-led than procedure-led.
Yeah.
And that's what I tried to do with every book.
Yeah. Because you had started writing, well, you've written 3 crime novels which hadn't done particularly well, but that you did very well writing kind of horror thrillers, supernatural thrillers. Did you find them satisfying or not? Were you always thinking, actually, I want to be doing this other thing?
I wrote my first 4 or 5 success. I mean, Possession came out. I wrote Possession, which was the first kind of supernatural thriller in 87, and it was a sort of novel that had an element of crime. I mean, it was about a boy who murders his kind of girlfriend, but then it starts off the first chapter. He dies, and then he comes back and basically haunts his mother. And when that book came out, I'd had these 3 disastrously unsuccessful spy thrillers. And then Victor Gollancz read Possession, and they loved it. And they said, how would you like to... Do you mind if we call you a horror writer? This was in 1987. At that time, horror was really in the ascendant. Mm. You know, there was James Herbert, Stephen King, Pete Straub, a whole raft of horror writers in America and England. And I was just delighted that a publisher was willing to have faith in me and back me. So I said, "Yes, please, thank you." And it became a kind of poison chalice, because I then wrote another 4 supernatural thrillers. But by the mid-90s, horror had gone sort of down like that, and I wasn't writing horror, I was writing thrillers with a supernatural tinge, but horror got this kind of Sean Hudson kind of, blood and gore image, and it took me a decade to actually get it off my book jackets and to stop that perception.
Yeah.
I wrote a number of more conventional thrillers, but it wasn't really until Roy Grace that I think I managed to shake that sobriquet off.
Yeah. And, of course, although you wanted to write from the age of 7 or so, I think, when you were discovering Sherlock Holmes, you actually went to film school and then you started a career. And I've got to ask you about those movies that you produced.
Yeah, I started making horror movies. Back in first time was 1972. Made a whole series. Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things. I Dismembered Mama.
We're talking class here, you can tell.
Yeah, class, yeah. Blood Orgy of the She-Devils. The Corpse Grinders. It's about a hamburger restaurant. Then I made a comedy, which I wrote and produced, called Spanish Fly, with Terry Thomas and Leslie Phillips.
Wow.
Barry Norman gave it the great accolade of calling it the worst British film since the Second World War. And the least funny British funny film ever made. I did, in my career in movies, make some I was proud of. Under Milk Wood with Richard Burton and Liz Taylor. And made The Merchant of Venice in 2004 with Al Pacino. But writing is... The problem with making movies is that... And I'm going through this right now in terms of the development of Roy Grace for television. It's a committee process. I mean, the beauty about writing a novel is I don't have to change a single word that I write, and it's me. I mean, I listen to my editor, and I think any author's dumb if they don't, but I don't have to. In a movie, you've got 20 people who all claim ownership at almost every given point. You know, you have two or three producers who all know it's their film. The director who says, actually, it's my movie. Four lead, massively egotistic actors who all know it's their film. The director of photography who thinks everybody's an idiot because it's his film. The editor, the composer, the production designer, and ultimately the distributor. So, you know, every movie is just a constant battle.
Yeah. You mentioned that production for TV. I'm surprised that Roy Grace hasn't hit the screens yet. Are things happening about that?
Yeah, it is in development in a good way at the moment, but I can't say too much yet. But hopefully, there'll be some news in the next couple of months.
Oh, okay.
But good news.
I seem to remember you'd had quite an odd approach for a TV company wanting to do Roy Grace.
A few years back, I've been very. Because as a producer myself, I've screwed up a few good books. Yeah, I know how it can be done. and I've always been determined not... I'd rather Roy Grace was never made than was made wrong. And first time I sold the rights was about 5 years ago. And after about a year of development, I got a phone call from the company. And I had made it a term. And if I didn't like the way it was going, I could get the rights back. And they said, great news. BBC Scotland wants to put up all the money. I said, that's great, but why do they want to finance a detective series set in Brighton? Said, they had this great idea of moving Roy Grace to Aberdeen. I said, has anybody read the books? Oh, yeah, they think Roy could get, you know, transferred to Aberdeen Police. I said, Foxtrot Oscar. I think a couple of things I got from the movie industry. One was... In fact, in television, I, some years ago, sold a comedy series, which actually didn't make it beyond development for the pilot, but I spent some time working in LA. I think the reason so many American comedies are so sharp is that in England we tend to have one writer, or maybe two, that's 10, and you bounce ideas off each other. And my first brief was, you have to have a gag every 15 seconds. And they reckon that half of the audience in America at any given time are channel surfing. So they'll watch something, hit them with a gag, they'll wait for the next one. And so on until they're hooked. I don't have a gag every 15 seconds in my Roy Grace novels. But it did teach me a lesson about writing, which is you have to constantly grab your reader's attention. You can't assume they're going to stay with you for pages and pages and pages without putting something... to grab them in. So it did teach me the importance of pace.
Yeah. Does that mean that you plot in advance and figure out where the kind of quick changes are going to go, or do you just write? Do you just set off and write?
Sometimes I plot about the first 20% in quite big detail, and the ending, I always know, have a roadmap where I want to get to. It may sometimes change. And I also, I plot what I call some gosh wow moments, where I think, where they're going to be like big surprises or big set piece scenes that I really enjoy writing. But I love the spontaneity. I love, you know, sitting with my vodka martini at 6 in the evening and music blasting and something pops in my head that wasn't there 10 seconds ago. I've had that a few times. in the third Roy Gray's Not Dead Enough, and there's, you know, I've got a character called Skunk, who's a drug dealer in Brighton, living in a camper van. And he just popped in my head. And I thought, I want to write about this character. I'd seen these characters driving around Brighton. There's an area where they would live, and they'd be untouched by the traffic wardens. And I just wondered who these people are. So I then asked, next day I phoned up an officer on the drugs team in Brighton. I said, yeah, tell me about the lives of these guys. And I slowly built up a character from that.
Yeah.
And he became an important part of the book.
Yeah.
So I like a combination of planning and spontaneity.
Tell me about Brighton as a character, this incredibly complicated seaside town, which has got a whole range of things going on in it.
Well, as a guy who's written about Brighton yourself, and since the topics of your books as well, which is the trunk murders, Brighton has always had this very dark, seedy undertow. Mm. The railway line's blamed for it. In 1841, they built the railway line from London to Victoria. Up until that point, all the villains in London were kind of stuck in London. And they came down to Brighton. They bought prostitution, cockfighting, illegal gambling, protection racketeering. You know, Brighton was a much nicer place to be. And in 1932, after the trunk murders, Brighton became known. It had a sobriquet, the crime capital of the UK and the murder capital of Europe. And there's another word for it, another expression.
Yeah, I'm trying to think what it is as well. We'll get back to that.
That sobriquet has never gone. Graham Greene, who was a big influence on me, Brighton Rock was the novel that made me want to be a crime writer. I remember reading that when I was 14. There, this extraordinary novel which had the inner lives of the villains.
But also the best opening.
Best opening line ever written, I think.
Yeah.
Well, certainly one of the best... which was, within 30 minutes of arriving in Brighton, Hale knew they meant to murder him.
Yeah.
I defy anybody to not read the next line.
Absolutely.
It's also got, I think, one of the best last lines. And the movie, the original movie, very beautiful interpretation of it. But if you were a criminal and you wanted to design your perfect environment, you would design Brighton. It's got everything that a criminal wants. Starting with, it's got all the escape routes, all the seaports, Channel Tunnel, 25 minutes to Gatwick Airport, 50-minute train to London, fast road network. It's got a major seaport on both sides, great for bringing in drugs, great for exporting stolen merchandise, miles of unguarded coastline, Shoreham Airport with no customs, no immigration. It's got the largest number of antique shops in the UK, so great for fencing stolen goods. It's got two universities, massive young, hip community, and the largest gay community in the UK, so it's a huge recreational drugs market. It's got a title the tourist board don't like me saying. It's for 10 years running, it's been the injecting drug death capital of the UK. Lost the title last year to Liverpool, but I'm happy to say we got it back. The last three chief constables and the current commander of Brighton Hove have all told me that Brighton is the favoured place to live in the UK for First Division criminals. and it's a lovely, lovely city.
With a nice microclimate.
With a nice microclimate. I did have I get these emails quite often. I had a very sweet one about 6 months ago from a Dutch girl. Said, my friend and I are thinking of visiting Brighton, but we are a little bit scared after reading your books. So I emailed back and I said, I'm sure you'll be okay, just like in any city, you know, keep your eyes open. And she emailed me back some weeks ago saying, you were right, we had a nice time and we weren't robbed. Result.
And in fact, although Brighton is very important in your books, you do take the stories away from Brighton quite regularly. And also you deal with kind of issues which have got a much wider application, whether it's identity theft or somebody pretending to be dead after 9/11 or whatever it might be. Is it those kind of issues or those ideas that come to you first when you start in a Roy Grace novel?
Yeah, I like writing about issues, and I think that, you know, with Dead Like You, which is my last Roy Grace book, I was very interested to write about the subject of rape, and a very difficult subject to approach. But I wanted to tackle it because the crime rate, for murder, the clear-up rate in the UK is 93%. For rape, it's a staggering 2%. And the effect on the victims, we talked a little about this in the panel yesterday, is devastating. And part of that is because it's very, very hard to get a conviction because it's one person's word against another. But I was inspired by that I went to a lecture in the States given by the senior investigating officer on the Rotherham Shoeman case. And that was a fascinating case. This was a guy, because one of the things that does interest me, and it's a common theme, I guess, in all of my Ray Grace novels, is how many of the worst criminals are such seemingly ordinary people. You know, the nice gentleman next door that feeds your cat when you're away or whatever. And this was a guy, his name was James Lloyd. He, between 1983 and 1987, in the Rotherham and Barnsley area of South Yorkshire, attacked and raped a whole series of women late at night outside bars, drag them into alleyways, tie them up, rape them, and then take their shoes. And he then stopped. And it wasn't until 2003, police got a breakthrough and they arrested a woman for drink driving. And they got a DNA sample which matched the profile of the rapist. It's what they call a familial match, so it's a partial match. And they went to see her and they said, "Do you have a brother?" And she said, "Yes, but he's a very respectable businessman." And he was. His name was James Lloyd. He was 47 years old, manager of a huge printing company, Freemason, happily married, two kids who adored him. Yeah. And his sister rang him and said, "I've just had a strange visit from the police." And his reaction was to try and hang himself that night. They raided his office the next day, and they found a trap door under his office, under his chair. And under that trap door were 126 pairs of stiletto-heeled shoes, each wrapped in cellophane. And this fascinated me. And one of the things I wanted to do was find out what kind of person becomes a rapist. And as with so many things in life, it's not just one category. It's a number of different. But one of the categories is the common house burglar. Fortunately, the house burglar is a fading breed, because the old traditional burglar who shins up your drainpipe at 3 a.m. and steals your Georgian silver can now make much more money as a drug dealer or internet fraudster. But they're still around. I asked the governor of Lewis Prison, which is my local big prison, if he had a career burglar who'd talk to me. And he came back to me and said, "I've got just the right guy for you." And I was given an hour and a half in an interview room with this guy. He was 42, gangly, talked like this. And he told me his life story. And I said, "How did you start?" He said, "Well, I grew up in this council estate outside Brighton in Molescombe." And he said, "No, when I was 15, I did a neighbour's house. I got 2 years. And I came out and I realised you're going to get the same jail whether you do a poor house or a posh house. So I decided to specialise in posh houses in Brighton." He said, "The problem is, I'm not very good. I do keep getting caught." He said, "Well, one of the things you've got to do is you've got to leave a back door or back window open. So if the owners come back, you leg it out the back." He said, "Well, I did this big house in Dyke Road in Brighton. And it was in November." I said, "And the owners came back and I legged it out the back in the darkness." He said, "Well, I didn't know they had a swimming pool, did I?" But I'm going to get, before I shut up, I'm going to give you one tip. This is for everybody in these harsh economic times. This is a tip that could save you a lot of money. I said to this guy, I said, "When you come out of prison, what do you do for money?" He said, "Well, you get about £50. I said, "Don't go very far." He said, and he said, "It's hard to get a job because I've got 171 previous convictions." But he said, "I've worked out this really good scheme." He said, "What I do, I go to a big supermarket, Tesco Superstore, Asda Superstore, wait outside till somebody's come out with a fully laden trolley and they throw the receipt in the bin. I just take the receipt out the bin, get a trolley, go back in, and I match everything to the receipt. So when I check out, no argument." So there you go. Free groceries.
There's a Tesco Express just across the road, in case you hadn't realised that. Just a final question from me before I invite questions from the audience. You seem to have had quite a posh upbringing. Your mother was a glovemaker to the Queen. You went to Charterhouse. Why the interest in the dark side of life? Or is it because of that posh upbringing?
I think I've always had that. I mean, Charterhouse was quite brutal. I was bullied there. I was constantly plotting how to kill the people who bullied me. I was constantly plotting terrible tortures for teachers who I didn't like. So I think maybe the Charterhouse brought the kind of darkness out of me.
Okay. Thanks for your patience with me, Peter. Let's get some questions from the audience. Yes, lady here.
You clearly spend a lot of time getting your research details right and police procedure. Did it take you very long to get the balance right between how much ends up in the book and how much you know but don't put in?
Does it take you very long to balance the research with how much you actually put into the book?
It's a very good question. William Faulkner once famously said, as a writer, you have to learn to kill your little darlings. And there is always a temptation, if you've learnt something, to put it in. And I have one golden rule, which is I have this imaginary sign in front of my face all the time I'm writing, which is, does it drive the narrative forward? And if it passes that test and is relevant to the narrative, yes. But, I remember, I think it was a Robert Ludlum book I was reading, and it was about a page and a half on how to dismantle and clean an AK-45. I thought, probably don't really need to know that. but every now and then I get a nugget that I think is interesting, and sometimes my editor will say, I think that should come out because it kills the pace. But I think there is an element that readers like to learn. I like to learn when I'm reading. You know, I have a scene in Dead Man's Grip, which is a couple of pages with a paramedic crew. Just sitting around, as they do, waiting for a call. And I just thought it was interesting. And my editor said to me, I don't know if we need that. And I said, yeah, I think we do, because I think everybody sees ambulances. And you don't know actually what goes on inside them. So I thought, yes, it is. So I think there's a balance.
Okay, thanks. I forgot to say that the most interesting question, of course, wins a bag of books. So, yes.
In your years of riding along with the police departments and the medics and so on, have you seen changes in the kinds of crimes that are occurring?
Have you seen changes in the kind of crimes occurring over the years that you've been researching with the police?
I think that in the UK, the crimes have been fairly consistent. If anything, there is a very big change. And touching on something I said earlier about burglary, I was... I go to what's called morning prayers, which is a 9:30 briefing meeting in Brighton's John Street Police Station every day. And they review every what they call critical incident that's happened in the city in the last 24 hours, where the missing people are, where anybody who's wanted, people who've jumped bail. So it's a review of everything that takes a half an hour. And I was there one day about 4 years ago, and the commander of Brighton Hove turned to me and said, you've come on a historic day. This is the first day since records began. There has not been an overnight burglary in the city of Brighton and Hove. And I said, fantastic, you've won the war on crime. And he laughed. And he said, I said it earlier, he said, no, he said, the traditional nighttime creeper burglar can now make so much more money, drug dealing or internet fraud. He hasn't got to be out late at night. He hasn't got to try and find somebody to flog the stuff the next day. But the converse is, and where the big change is that street crime, street robbery, has gone up dramatically. I mean, 80% of all the crime in every city in the UK is street robbery, which is daytime. And by street robbery, I mean it's somebody breaking into your car and taking your sat-nav, grabbing your handbag while you're sitting in a bar having a drink, muggings by drug users in need of money for drugs. And if to be if you are a drug addict in a UK city, and it's similar throughout the whole of Europe, it's going to cost you a minimum of £50 a day more likely between 80 and £200 a day. And you are only going to get that one of two ways. Either if you're a female, you could maybe go on the game, but otherwise it's stealing. And you will get roughly 10% of the value of what you steal from a fence. So you don't have to do the sums very hard to figure out why there's so much street crime.
Okay, thank you. Yes, down in the back there.
And there's a lady back there.
What qualities to be a good crime writer are required?
I think a devious mind. I think to be a good writer, for anybody to write well, I think probably the biggest quality is to learn from what you read. I've always been an obsessive reader since a very small age, and I've always analysed the books that I've liked. So if I come, I'm always looking for a book that I read where I think, bloody hell, I'm jealous, wish I'd written that. Because that's when I feel I'm learning. So I think that's one of the key elements.
Okay, thank you. There's somebody right at the back, and then we'll come forward. Yep. Might you write a different genre or children's books?
Well, I did write one children's book, but I found it very hard because the language of kids is very difficult, and I was lucky I got a teacher friend to have her class read the book out in chapters as we went along. But I found it too hard, and it wasn't really what I wanted to do. But yes, and I have a standalone novel coming out in November called Perfect People, which is about designer babies. It's a thriller. But it's not about police. It's a subject that I've been fascinated with for a long time. And it's taken me 10 years to research and write this novel. It's about a couple who go to a secret clinic and literally choose the genes of their child. And my research for that was awesome. I remember about 9 years ago meeting the professor of brain genetics at Caltech in Pasadena. And he said, telling me about stuff they were working on, he said, we've just identified the cluster of genes responsible for empathy. He said, it won't be that long in the future where parents will be able to choose the level of empathy of their child. You know, am I going to have a sweet, gentle little boy who's going to get trodden on? Am I going to have somebody tough who could end up being a sociopath? And you'll be able to choose, do you want your kid to be good at ball games? And if you say, well, no, I don't want to enhance that, you're going to possibly bring him up in a genetic underclass because all his friends will have been enhanced. So it's a really big can of worms. And so that's what that I've chosen that as a light topic to write about.
What's the title of that?
It's called Perfect People.
And it's coming out?
It's published by Macmillan in November.
November.
Yeah.
Okay, that's great. You got a question?
How does your family feel about you being away so much doing research, and are they concerned about risk to you as a person going along with the police, etc.?
Good question. Being away so much doing research and also the dangers of doing that research.
Yeah, I think Helen's very happy the more I'm out of the house. You know, but I this is a cut. When I was researching for my novel Dead Tomorrow, one of the central characters is a 14-year-old Romanian girl who's believed to have been trafficked to England for her organs, and the police are looking for her. And I asked Brighton Police, the vice team, how they would set about looking for a 14-year-old girl. And they said, well, actually, we're looking for a girl right now, and we think she may have been co-opted into the sex trade. And we're going tomorrow evening on a tour of Brighton's brothels. Would you like to come with us? I said, yeah. And Brighton Police have a policy of allowing brothels to exist because they would rather working girls be inside where they're secure rather than outside in the streets and all the red light district and drugs that goes with that. So the next night I said to Helen, I'm just going out on a tour of brothels tonight, darling. Went down really well, as you can imagine. And we got to this, the first one, which is in the centre of Brighton. If anybody wants the address, I can. You won't want it, I tell you. This is a grotty building, and we go inside, and I'm with two uniform officers, male and female, and I'm wearing my kind of yellow police jacket with my notebook. And there's this enormous woman sitting eating pot noodles, stinks of cigarette smoke and cats, a manky carpet, a porno film playing on the wall, and a price list. And the officers asked this madame, they said, how many girls do you have tonight? She said, oh, we've got six here. Could we speak to them? So she phones down. Next thing, this guy in a business suit scurries out with his hands over his face.
Yeah.
And then these girls come up and they sit down and the police are interviewing them. And I'm standing just behind with my notes. And this madame keeps looking at me. And she says, I know you, don't I? And I go, no, you don't.
Right at the back there, yeah. Have you come across the perfect crime in your research, or the nearest you could get to a perfect crime?
That's a really good question. I wrote my little novella, The Perfect Murder, which I did for the Quick Reads a couple of years back. And that came out of a quote. I asked the chief constable of Sussex that very question. I said, do you think there is such a thing as a perfect murder? He said, yes, it's the one we never hear about. And he wasn't being flip. I went with the police some years ago to an open day at the Missing Person Helplines office in Barnes. And I was staggered by one presentation which said that every year in the UK, 230,000 people are reported missing. Now, most of those turn up within a few days. If they're not back within 30 days, they are gone for good, unless they're in a canoe, Mr. Canoe Man Darwin. But at any given point in time, there are 11,500 people permanently missing in the UK. And it's the same pro rata to population throughout the Western world. And my thought is, where are they? Okay, some have done, like Ronnie Wilson in Dead Man's Footsteps, run off to reinvent themselves. But I doubt some have faked their disappearances, some have run off with lovers, some have had accidents. But undoubtedly, there are a percentage of those missing people who are murder victims who've never been discovered under the likes of potting sheds like Fred West or Austrian cellars. And I think there's probably a lot more people murdered every year than we ever hear about.
That prompts a question about Roy Grace's wife, Sandy, but unfortunately we're out of time, so we're going to have to leave this on a cliffhanger here. Thank you all for coming. Thank you for being such an attentive and responsive audience. Please thank you for coming.